Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Rusty thinks I'm going overboard on the sumac thing. And, part of the reason I stress about identification of these kinds of plants is because I want to make sure that everybody can easily distinguish between different types of plants, particularly when one of the plants that's kind of similar can be a little toxic for people. It's like poison ivy. Your body, it actually doesn't do things to your body. It's not poison in a real sense. The funny thing about most poison ivies and sumacs, poison sumacs, the ones that are poisonous, and only one is, and it's pretty rare actually. But the thing about them is that they're not so much a poison to your body as they are. It's like they tease your immune system. It's like they bait your immune system. And your immune system goes into overdrive. And so people say, oh, gosh, I got poison ivy. I spread poison ivy all over my body when I got it. I don't even understand. This was under my clothes. I don't understand how I got it all over. I must have touched myself. Maybe not. Because a lot of times you've got to recognize that it's your immune system going berserk. It's not an actual toxicity of the plant. It's your immune system going berserk in the face of the oils of this plant. And so your body breaks out in hives, essentially, in places where you may not have even come in contact with the poison. And a lot of people who are susceptible to poison ivy have that problem. There it is. But how do you distinguish them all? There are a lot of – everybody says, well, poison ivy has three leaves. And that's true, and it helps you a lot because there's a lot of vines that are similar to poison ivy, like a Virginia creeper, that have five leaves. And it's pretty simple. Virginia creeper's everywhere. People freak out when they see it. Oh, it's poison ivy. Well, no, it's got five leaves. Poison ivy always has three leaves. Always has three leaves. But there are a lot of plants, the other plants that have these little groupings of three leaves. Obviously, clover does, but it's very different. And there are even other sumacs that have groupings of three leaves that are not poisonous at all. So you want to be careful about it. But let's just talk about the sumacs, because the sumacs are wonderful things, and they're beginning to flower now. They have these really beautiful flowers, and those flowers produce fruits, and those fruits are absolutely delicious. We make there's a great sumac lemonade you can make from winged sumac and from smooth sumac, both of which grow. Rusty, you have winged sumac. I think we've pretty well decided that. Looked at both plants. I pulled the picture up a little more to where I can see. There are clearly wings on both of those. The little winged sumac has little wings in between the little leaflets. You'll see it on the stems. So that's winged sumac, no question. And the fruits are delicious. You can make a great lemonade. Just soak it. Don't boil it. That's the secret to using sumac, is don't boil it, because the boiling releases something that gives a little off taste. Just put it in the sun if you want to make sun tea out of it, or just soak those berries in that. It is a beautifully colored, claret-colored lemonade that is just absolutely delicious. You can use it as a basting sauce when you're grilling. It really makes a great basting sauce when you're grilling. You can use the berries, too, for a dry rub, and I'll have to figure out a little bit more about how to do that. I think you probably want to dry them first, but it's similar to the Middle Eastern sumac that is often used as a spice in a dried form. You can buy it in grocery stores. So it's a really cool thing. How do you distinguish them? Listen, there's only one toxic sumac. It's pretty rare. It's always around the edges of wetlands, around pitcher plant bogs, usually in a shrubby area around pitcher plant bogs, or sometimes around swamps, usually where there's a little flow of water, but not much, just a little bit of flow of water. And the way to tell the toxic one is that the stems, where the little leaflets are, have this brilliant red color. It is absolutely beautiful, but it is a brilliant, distinctive red-colored stem that holds the little leaflets in place. And that's one easy way to tell. Otherwise, you don't have to worry, and we'll figure it out. You know, Rusty, I'm going to look at you. I'm going to have to call this picture up, which may be a little bit harder than the winged sumac, but I'm looking. It looks like a whimbrel, but we'll come back and look at it. Hey, Deborah, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, I have a century plant that I am trying to get rid of, and I've tried to cut it down, and the juice splattered on me and burns like acid. How do I get rid of the century plant?
You know, I never knew that the juice would burn. That is just crazy. I've never heard of that. But I just, it's new to me. Huh?
Yeah, I tried to cut the limbs off, and I was using like limb cutters, and it splattered on me, and it started burning like an acid type.
Did it happen? Did it happen slowly, or did it happen quickly?
It happened sort of quickly. I thought I had ants on me, and it ended up being the juice that's popped on me.
Yes.
And the internet says they're very toxic.
Agaves, century plants. Well, that's interesting. I wonder if it's a phytotoxicity that results from sunlight. You know, what I would do is wear gloves and a long-sleeve shirt to cut them. I'll have to look up the toxicity of those plants. I mean, obviously, agaves are used for making drinks with. They have lots of sugars, and I have never really... And I've messed with agaves before, but never really encountered that kind of reaction. My ignorance. I'll have to look at it. I'm just not sure. But I think I would use gloves and a long sleeve shirt. If I were cutting it back.
Yeah. Well, see what you can find out for me, because I do want to get rid of it.
Yeah, okay. And this has got the big, long, long leaves that are kind of fleshy, right?
And has the needle on the end of it.
Has a needle on the end of it. Okay, let me look that up and see what I can find. Just not something that I had ever really encountered before, unless it interacts with sunlight and makes you more susceptible to sunlight. But let me look at that, and I'll see what I can find.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Deborah. Hey, Tim, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, hi. How are you today?
Good.
I've got actually two questions maybe you can answer me. I started a rose cutting, and basically I just took like a pencil size about 8 inches long of a cutting of one of the rose bushes and stuck it in the garden bed, and it's doing everything it's supposed to do now. I want to know if I put it in a bed I really didn't want it to be in. Can I take that out, put it into a pot, and then move it to where I want it later on, or is this a bad time to do that?
Yes, you certainly can, and it depends on whether you can take care of it in that bed. Here's the thing. It's going to move easiest in fall.
Okay.
But if you take a big enough – why don't you wait until fall if you can take care of it where it is and then move it this fall? There's a couple of things. It's a little – there's some issues because you're going to have to knock some of the soil off of it to put it into a container.
Yeah.
And let's don't mess with success right now. It likes where it is. Let's leave it there for the time being. Let's, if you can take care of it, don't keep it too wet. Keep it just about right. And then move it. And fall, meaning October, be a good time to move it.
Okay. And my other quick question was, I planted a blackberry bush last year, an Apache thornless, and I've got a ton of blackberries on it this year, and they didn't get very big, but they taste very bitter. And they're nice and black, and when I harvested them, they came off the vine really well, but they're very, very bitter, and supposedly they're supposed to be sweet.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm not sure I can answer that question. Okay. I there's a lot of variability in the taste of commercial blackberries and where they grow. And, you know, I think maybe they respond to heat poorly. They may also, it may also be the result of diseases that don't allow them to concentrate sugars in the fruit because they're not able to move things through the plant as much. If your plants are dwarfed and not doing as well this year, they may not be moving as much of the nutrients that they need to produce sugars. And blackberries, you know, one of the, and particularly commercial blackberries, can be hard in southeastern climates, and particularly on the Gulf Coast, because they really don't like being in one place more than a year or two. Because
and this is the first year they planted. Last year I planted it and just got the canes, and this is the first year it's actually producing berries.
Producing berries.
Well,
You know, and it just sounds like it's not concentrating sugars very well. That can sometimes be, have you got plenty of sunlight for these guys?
Yeah, about 8 hours a day.
Yeah, so that's not a problem. Well, I just, for some reason, it is not concentrating the sugars the way it should. Okay. I'll have to look at that and think about that. I don't know whether heat could be a factor. It may be drought could be a factor. Let me look and see which ones affect bricks more. And give me a call back next week and let's try to sort that out a little better.
Okay, will do. Thank you very much.
All right, Tim. Good to hear from you.
Great day.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Plain Gardening. Beautiful day. Warm day. Humid day. That's why it's life on the Gulf Coast, folks. That's what it's like. It's nice. I like that. Hey, so Rusty, when you send me pictures sometimes, folks, I don't have the most, Charlie, how can I politely say this without offending our...
we got an ancient computer with an even worse monitor.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlie.
Okay. Glad I could help.
I didn't want to say it out loud. So, but you know, it's okay. It's okay. That's the way things work, and we don't waste a lot of money here. Okay. So here's the thing. So I have to take a little bit of a look at it and look at it. So Rusty sent me some pictures of a couple of birds, and they're pretty big looking birds, and I could not tell, but they're whistling ducks. I called the image up, looked at it a little better. Whistling ducks. Black-bellied whistling ducks. They are really interesting. They're an interesting group of ducks, and they're wild ducks.
They don't quack.
They breed down here. They kind of have a. They are. They're described as boisterous. I like that, boisterous. But you often see them in large groups, and they don't have the typical quack. They have kind of a sound that they make that's a little different. Black-bellied whistling ducks is what you're looking at there, you often see them around parks and agricultural fields and other things like that. They deal with humans better than some other ducks. They've learned to adapt to that. We probably have increased the numbers of black-bellied whistling ducks as a result. Hey, Kitty, I'm listening. What's up?
Volunteer sunflower came up in my yard before anything was planted. I just happened to spot it before I weeded it out. It grew. It's well over 8 feet tall, and I got confused, but I've counted 26 to 29 heads, blooming heads on it. Is this a usual known variety of sunflower?
26 to 29, so they were all pretty small, right?
The petaling was not so abundant, but the center was the size of a coffee cup opening.
Yeah, so they make varieties like that, and yeah, so yes, that is very typical. You can actually buy varieties that have multiple flowers that are smaller.
I called him Jack. He must have been Jack Sunflower.
Yeah, so it's big. Well, you know, and
tall. It doesn't have to be propped. It's standing up.
That's,
all the flowering heads now are splayed out because they're getting heavier.
Heavier. Yeah, that's right. So it could have been, you know, so natives.
Well, I just wanted to know if it was an extreme variety and I should give it to somebody. I'm just going to save it and plant it if I can save.
That's right. That's exactly what I would do. So I think it was probably a variety that came. Somebody was feeding birds locally, or something like that, and it came up. But you know, native sunflowers often have more than one head. It's typical for them to have multiple flowers on a plant. And
these are like all the way down the stalk.
Yeah, and that sounds very nice. So I'd definitely keep
it's
the
gorgeous.
Seed.
I'll send you a picture of it, actually.
Please.
It makes sense. If you wanted to sell bird seed, you would want a sunflower with 29 heads.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the reason why they've selected for single heads has to do with harvest and the ease of harvest. So if you're looking for just having that single head makes it much easier to harvest than if you've got multiple small heads. That's why, you know, it's funny, this thing about farming is you got to think about everything. You got to think about, oh man, all those little heads sure may be nice and maybe I get more seeds that way, but on the other hand, I'm going to have to pick every one of those little flowers.
Yes.
So it's
easier. Well, then okay, I'll grow them and I'll sell bundles of sunflowers.
That's right. But they're pretty. And so you're not growing for commercial production, they're great for you.
It just came up in my yard, and yeah. I've marveled at it ever since it came up. It came up so vigorously to begin with. It was notable in a field of weed.
Well, please send me a picture of it.
I shall. If I learn, I'm working on smartphone business. So.
All right. Well, and there's the possibility it's a native sunflower. So let's look at that too and see if
fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So
okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Please send me that picture.
Hey, Bill.
Hey. Yes.
Before we go to the next call, I have friends that live in Panama City, and they got ravished by Hurricane Michael last October. And all the old oak trees, beautiful shady lane, they're all gone. In the middle of all that destruction, they had a big sunflower come up.
Yeah.
And they had never seen sunflowers there before.
Yeah, well, seeds get moved around.
She said it's a beautiful plant, big, huge flowers on it.
Yep. They will surprise you sometimes. Hey, Joan, I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah, hi. A bunch of years ago, I've moved down here from New Jersey, different climate. And it would always be nice to see the forsythias, that one of the first plants that blooms in the spring. So taking a walk around here, right where I live, my immediate neighborhood here, I saw a forsythia plant growing, and I snapped off a small branch and brought it home, and I don't know how I started it, but I did get it to root. It's growing nicely in my yard, but it has never flowered.
Thank you, Joan, for letting everybody know this is important to know. Forsythia doesn't...
Well, actually, no one but me knows that the plant is there.
Yeah, Forsythia does not get enough chill hours to bloom.
Oh, you mean I have to pack it in ice cubes or something at a certain point in the winter?
That's right. So it's there's a thing called chill hours. So if you're a plant and you have to live with freezing temperatures, you kind of want to know, how do I know when this winter's over so I can put on new growth? So they have ways of calculating. Isn't that funny? Plants are kind of smart. They have ways of calculating how many hours of winter there's already been and how many more hours of winter there's likely to be in the climate that they're adapted to.
Right.
And it's called chill hours. They have it's and it really is hours hours around 45 degrees, hours below 45 degrees are called chill hours.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get enough, it doesn't turn on the signal in the plant that says, oh, winter's over, I can flower now.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens with peaches, it happens with plums, it happens with apples, it happens with lots of species that grew up in areas that are cold climates, cooler climates, because they really have to be very sophisticated about it. And so you move them down here, and it doesn't get very cold in winter. They don't accumulate enough chill hours, and they say, hey, wait, I don't get it. What's going on? And they never flower.
Mm. Now, I've thought about that, and this is not a big but it's a small but, because if it's just a few streets over from where I'm living here, where I picked that thing years ago.
Yeah.
Right here in Midtown Mobile.
So
it was blooming there. That's how I knew it was a forsythia. It was not just the leaves, but the flowers on it.
Yeah. So once every 10 or 15 years, increasingly, probably, let's say, I would say once every 5 years in the old climate regime. When we used to get a lot more cold temperatures than we do now,
yes,
and a lot more freezing days than we do now, and a lot more consistent chill hours.
Yeah.
In that climate regime, I would say that maybe once every 5 years you'd get enough for it to bloom. And it might not be great bloom. It wouldn't be the kind of bloom you remember from New Jersey, but it would bloom a little bit.
Right.
but now, particularly after a winter like the previous one, where we had almost no chill hour accumulation, we had very little chill hour accumulation, it just wouldn't bloom at all because it would be very confused.
Yeah, and when I first moved down here, there were a couple of, I don't remember which, but in fact, there was even snow one year right after I moved down here.
Right.
I was quite thrilled. But maybe that's what this poor plant of mine had endured, and I walked past it, and it was flowering beautiful. Oh, excellent. Those yellow flowers in early spring are so beautiful. Okay, I'm not going to kill it though. It can stay out there.
Yeah, that's fine. And it, you know, it had been a while since I'd seen a forsythia and and in bloom. And I went to school in. Forsythias actually do fine, sort of Montgomery North. They do okay. It's just Montgomery South. They don't do okay. So I'd grown up with a few forsythias growing up, and they were doing just fine. And then, you know, I went to school around Asheville, and, boy, they just are just vibrant up there, just bloom incredibly well. And you take them for granted. And I moved to Mobile. I didn't really miss them until I went back up and saw one and thought, boy, that's pretty.
That's what happened to me when I walked past there. That's what I'm missing.
That's right.
It's bright, delicate yellow in early spring.
It is very nice. It's very beautiful. But it is not. On the other hand, if I were in Asheville, I would miss all the wonderful things that we have blooming here all year long, and some great yellows as well. So it is, but yeah, forsythia is going to be really hard because it needs the chill hours.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's the.
I understand.
Peonies the same way. If you noticed, no peonies down here.
No, I hadn't.
No peonies down here.
There's another one I can miss.
Lilacs.
That's right.
That's right.
It's a good thing I left my mother's lilac in the garden up there.
Yeah, and so no lilacs, no peonies, because they don't get enough chill hours. On the other hand, there's so many wonderful things. I'm so excited about my crinum lilies, which are about to bloom, which I wouldn't dare tell anybody in New Jersey how beautiful my crinum lilies are, because it would just break their hearts. And camellias, you can't do those up there. I mean, sort of, but not really. And so there's just a whole bunch of other things that we can do here. Yeah.
Oh, the gardenias that I bought when I first came here, and then I planted them in the garden. They were so full of white blue blossoms.
Yeah.
This year, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, they had a great, lovely year, didn't they? They were great.
Yeah, they did. So is it time? Because I want to make sure they'll do something pretty special next year. Should I just clip off the tops of the gardenias?
Do not clip off the tops. Do you remember how you prune forsythia?
No.
Okay.
I never used, it came up every spring all by itself, and finished off. I don't ever remember.
So what you do is you prune at the base. Don't prune at the tops.
Oh, really?
So you go to the base. You prune out each year on your gardenia, just like with the forsythia. You prune out the biggest, heaviest, fattest stem, because that's going to be the tallest one. Sometimes you might want to prune out two, and sometimes you might want to prune out none.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take out the biggest, heaviest stem right at the base,
mm-hmm.
you open the plant up just a little bit, which is good. And you take out the tallest stem, so you reduce the height, mm-hmm. and you keep a nice shape that way. And that way you get more vigorous. The younger ones are going to fruit better. The other thing you want to do is give it a little bit of cottonseed meal. Okay?
Well, oh, okay.
A bucket load of cottonseed meal. Okay. Just a small bucket of cottonseed meal around the plant. Mm-hmm. All right?
All right.
Joan, good to hear from you.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Hey, we'll be back, folks.
Hide the deadly black tarantula.
Daylight come and we want to
live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and we want to 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and we want to.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of pictures people are sending in. I don't know whether to put my glasses on or take them off. It's hard to tell sometimes. John in Irvington, you got two oaks here. You're right. The top one, John, with the very long, elongated leaves, where the leaves are like 10 times longer than they are wide, 7 or 8 times longer than they are wide. You can bet that it is one of two oaks. It is either a water oak or a laurel oak. I'm going to bet water oak, but it could be an upland laurel oak. It could be one or the other. Water oaks do funny things. When seedlings of oaks are young, they do all kind of crazy things. And boy, will they mess you up. They'll just mess you up. You think you know something about oaks, and then you try to figure out those seedlings, and boy, you say, I don't know. But that is I'm pretty sure that's a water oak seedling. There's some technical issues I'd have to look at to determine absolutely for sure, but it's a water oak or a laurel oak. Neither one of them, of course, are particularly long-lived. They're short-lived oaks. The second one you've got with lots of lobes on it is interesting, too, and I don't have enough resolution on my screen to be sure, but it's, you know, it could be a red oak, but I'm pretty sure that it is an overcup oak, which vaguely resembles a red oak in some ways, but it's really a white oak. It's a member of the white oak group. If you have a tree around, if you have an overcup oak around, I would say that that is an overcup oak. If you see a mama overcup anywhere, you know what an overcup oak looks like? It's got those acorns that have the hood on the acorn, nearly covers the cup or hood on the acorn, nearly covers the nut inside. So you almost can't see the nut for the top that is spread over. That's why it's called overcup. It's a great oak. It's a really cool oak. I think that's what it is. And Dan, yes, indeed, you got an assassin bug that is plugged its proboscis or whatever you call it, its spear into a leaf hopper. A two-lined leaf hopper, and boy, they are really good, aren't they? They are really good at doing what they do. Assassin bugs, one of the really nice things. One of the things they can usually confuse them with juvenile stink bugs, but there's only just one or two of the assassin bugs on a plant. You won't see big numbers of them. Greg said he actually got some poison sumac. That's interesting. Somebody's got some Korean ball squash in Oakley. Ooh, it looks beautiful. Pick it now. Don't let it get bigger. You know, the smaller ones, I think, are really better for cooking. The seeds don't develop as much, and so they're really good. You can cook the bigger ones, but there it is. Jim in Georgetown, that is Smilax. That is Jackson vine. That is one. I don't know about the fruit being edible. I think I said I was going to look the fruit up. The tips of the stems are very edible. Tips of the stems are very, very edible. So you can use those. I don't, and so are the roots are edible too. I won't say very edible, but they're certainly edible, and they have been eaten before, and with they don't cause you any problems. It's just they have. I didn't think the taste was all that good, and it was a lot of trouble. But the stems are absolutely delicious. The tips of those stems are absolutely delicious. That is Smilax. That is Jackson vine. Let's call it Jackson vine or greenbriar. So it's kind of thornless at the top. It's one of the really nice things. What do we do about our rural areas? And I don't want to leave this hanging. And you're just going to have to think about it because you know this is Alabama. We're a rural state. So much of our politics is still governed by the rural areas. And you know, one of the interesting things is if everybody's poor in those areas, they're unhappy. Our politics are unhappy. Which they are sometimes. And, you know, it's a big problem. And we lose a lot of our potential when we don't have employment for people in these rural areas. Does everybody move to the city or suburbs? I don't know. Maybe that's the solution. I doubt it. I don't think that's probably a good thing in the long run. And I don't think these rural areas will ever be what they were in terms of population density and in terms of farming. But, you know, I think there is some potential for small farms. Here's the first thing I think that farming needs to do, and it's just what I tell gardeners. Figure out where you are. You know, here's the funny thing. We try to grow the same commodities in Alabama that they're growing in Indiana and Illinois. You know, soybeans, everybody's growing soybeans. You know that. In good soybean fields in Indiana, they're producing 50% more soybeans per acre than the average farmer in Alabama produces. How do you compete with that? You know, if you're in Illinois and you're in prime farm growing corn growing land, you're producing 25% more corn per acre, and everybody's getting pretty much the same price. How do you compete with that if you're in Alabama? Why do we go for the big commodities? It's because of federal price supports. It's because of habit. It's because of the machinery takes us there. It's because of all these other things. But we're at a disadvantage here on those big commodity crops. Cotton, I don't want to get into cotton. there are a few places in Alabama where you can grow cotton well, but there's fewer and fewer areas, and we get beat out because other people do it better and produce better specialty cotton. So our prices don't get what other people get for good, really good quality cotton. What do we do really well in Alabama? And the best things we do are not corn and not soybeans and not cotton. So how do we take advantage of Alabama's climate? That's the thing we need to ask ourselves. We'll come back and talk more about that.
Keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come and I have no place to stay. Well, all last night I sat on the levee and moaned. Well, all last night I sat on the levee and moaned. Thinking about my baby and my happy home. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And all these people have no place to stay.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Jim, you know, I have heard lots of things. Smilax is really, there's lots of edible parts of Smilax. And it has been used in a lot of interesting ways. Smilax is catbriar, greenbriar, sawbriar, the briar everybody complains about. It's got the big thorns. But Jackson vine, one of those with the very long leaves, leaves that are much longer than they are wide, and kind of shaped like a lance with both sides of the leaf parallel without any real lobes or indents. That one is really delicious. I mean, it is absolutely delicious if you take the tips of the green stems. The fruits, I have no idea. I've never heard anybody mention using the fruits. I'll just have to, you know, I don't know. I've just never heard anybody mention the fruits. I doubt they're poisonous. I doubt they'll hurt you, but they may not be very good. So, I just don't know. I don't know. There it is. Hey, so we're talking a little bit about farming in Alabama and rural areas and discovering where we are. It's really an important thing. So here's a classic case. You know, we actually aren't the best at growing cotton either. We're not the best at growing corn. We're not the best at growing soybeans. We get beat on price. We get beat on volume and on all of those per acre. Yield per acre. And so our prices are lower, and so we kind of defeat ourselves by trying to compete on those things. So what are here's an example. Here's a classic way in which we ignore where we are. So somebody's decided, oh, well, you know, what are we going to do? Let's grow hemp. Well, the hemp, we're not going to be any better growing hemp than we are at growing corn. Indiana's going to eat our lunch when it comes to growing hemp. Because hemp does not like this humidity. It does not like this heat of summer. We might be able to grow it, but we're not going to be able to grow it as well. So we're at a disadvantage once again. So I said, well, olive oil, man, let's grow some olive oil. Olive oil is from Spain. My goodness, folks, it's from Spain and Italy. Have you ever been to Spain and Italy? What about Spain and Italy reminds you of Alabama in terms of climate, in terms of soils, in terms of agriculture? They're very different climates. So will we be able to grow olive oil? Yes. Will it be quality olive oil? No. Will we have production? You see what I'm saying? So what if we really understood we were from Alabama? What would we think? You know, what do we do well? Well, we do camellias really well. We don't do forsythia that well. But boy, we do camellias really well down here. And you know, there's a camellia oil that is hard to get in the US. It has much better qualities than olive oil. It's widely used in Asian cooking. In fact, it's much. I much prefer it to using to olive oil. I use it almost exclusively now. It's kind of expensive, but it is much better olive oil to use. It's much better than olive oil. We could grow camellia oil great. In fact, there's been some real work in it, but nobody sits down and thinks about what could we do in Alabama that is really suitable to where we are. How do we do that? And camellia oil would be the kind of product that actually, because of the return per acre, it would be the kind of product small farmers could do really well. And we would control the market. Because that's where we are. We could control the market with camellia oil. How do we think about things like this? And how do we think about rural farming? It is sort of the same problem we have with gardening, is thinking, how do we do what we do really well? Instead of trying to be like Boston, instead of trying to be like Fort Wayne, Indiana, we ain't Fort Wayne, Indiana. We aren't Spain. We're Alabama. Let's be the best we can be. There's another thing with small farms that I want to talk about. And that is we need to be cooperative. We need co-ops. And that's how we get over the efficiency problems that we've had on farms and small farms. Because if you need a tool, even if you need a Ferrari, if every farmer has to buy the Ferrari and uses it only a few times a year, and they don't all need to use it at the same time, why not share the Ferrari? That's what co-ops were originally designed to do, and that's what we ought to be doing is setting up small co-ops that work really well for the small farmers, and that would help us tremendously with efficiency. Whether we're growing hops or whether we're growing, there's just a tremendous number of crops where if we were to develop co-ops, we would be in much better shape. There's a lot of ways of dealing with this, a lot of ways of thinking about this, a lot of ways of increasing employment, increasing opportunities in rural areas. Sorry, but I'm concerned about Alabama, and I want you to think about it too, because it's our state. And, you know, if we don't do something about the rural areas, it's gonna come back, and it's already biting us. It's already making it more difficult for us. Just wanted you to think about it. So John, that big oak nearby tells me that's a red oak, and that is the southern red oak, Spanish oak. So maybe your seedling there is actually a Spanish red. You can tell it's a Spanish red because look at the top of that leaf, John. You see how the top of that leaf looks like it kind of bends over like a sickle? That's what falcate means. That's the Latin word for southern red is falcata. It's falcate. It turns at the top like a sickle. You see what I'm saying? That's how you know it's southern red. You'll never miss it that way. Hey, Tara, thanks for your patience. I'm listening. What's up?
I just have one question, and you added a lot of answers to it already. What is it that Alabama farmers in all degrees are growing currently?
Yeah. You know, it used to be, and I mentioned this last week, there was a lot of diversity in the types of crops we were growing all over the state, huge in several counties. But increasingly, we have, since the 70s, we have lost diversity in the kinds of crops we grow. Corn and soybeans and cotton. I could say it over 50. Everywhere I go, corn and soybeans and cotton over and over and over and over and over again.
But we're getting, 50% of what?
But we are getting, our yields are less than the prime cotton and corn and soybean growing areas, and our quality is less than in the prime cotton growing areas.
But wasn't the soybean stuff instituted because it balances what the soil depletion is regarding the cotton and the corn?
Well, sort of. I wish that's an interesting thing. I guess soybeans is better than just growing corn and cotton, but it's still not enough.
You gotta go. Bye.
Bye. Good to hear from you.